Got a coach. Welcome to the panel. RNZ National, Wallace Chapman here. I'm with Dean Hall, video game designer and CEO of Rocketworks, and Rawani Pereira, journalist for The Hui. Someone says, exercise, get an e-bike. Anyone who thinks they aren't for exercise, they're mistaken. They encourage you to go further, longer, more often. Particularly good if you're heavier set. They get you moving, and I'm in love with mine. So that's a wonderful Friday afternoon little text there. Thank you for that. First up, big news today. The government has released details today around employers and unions setting minimum standards to implement the fair pay agreements. It is seen as the biggest workplace change in years. Says Workplace Relations Safety Minister Michael Wood, for too long, New Zealanders working in critical roles like cleaners, supermarket workers and bus drivers, whose work was essential to keep our country going during the pandemic, have been undervalued by our workplace relations system. The National Party has pledged to repeal the proposed legislation, saying Labour's stuck in the 70s with National Awards 2.0. With us first, we've got a couple of guests on this, and first up we have the CEO of Business NZ, Kirk Hope. Kia ora, Kirk.
Kia ora.
So what do you make of this?
Well, look, I mean, it's pretty clear from all of the employers that we talk to that they don't like them, they don't want them, they don't think they need it. I mean, I think if you look at some of the sectors that were seen as having a high number of vulnerable and low-paid workers, like, for example, bus drivers, ironically, those industries are often publicly funded. I think another area that the CTU wanted to target was aged care workers. Again, an area of public funding. So, I mean, if you want to use a sledgehammer to crack a nut, and this is what fair pay agreements will be doing, because you're taking an industry agreement that will affect workers nationally, it's a really significant change, and it will impose a lot of costs on the economy.
Okay, yeah, and it will also nationally lift the wages of some of our lowest paid, and that's got to be good for all of us, surely, Kirk.
Well, not really, because if the public funding mechanisms in those lowest paid sectors don't allow for it, or the procurement mechanisms don't allow for it, they simply, fair pay agreements won't make a bit of difference.
The government argues that such a scheme is necessary to stop a cowboy effect where employers who treat employees badly undercut their competitors on price and force wages down. We know this does happen. I mean, surely this is going to help in that, Kirk?
Well, I guess the example that they always use is the bus drivers. And again, I'll say the reason that it happened is because the public funding of that and the procurement around it was trying to drive prices lower for ratepayers. So if you want to fix some of these worst affected sectors, fix that. Don't use fair pay agreements to do it, because I mean it's the wrong tool at the wrong place at the wrong time.
All right, we've got Richard Wagstaff very shortly, but let's just bring our panel. Rawani, what do you reckon?
So Kirk, how do you, like, what is an instrument that you can use to do that?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that we've been thinking about and working on in conjunction with the government around training. So recognising and funding workplace-based training, because we recognise that's a way to increase skills and increase productivity and therefore drive wages up. Do it through productivity and training, but recognise the training, because one of the things that hasn't happened in New Zealand is that workplace-based training hasn't been properly funded.
All right, well, we do have a CEO here of a fairly large a firm, Rocketworks. Dean.
So when it first came out, I was definitely 100% against it, mainly because we fall through the cracks as a video game industry, and for me a lot of it is the devil's in the detail. You know, it sounds like a good idea, but, you know, a good example would be our immigration codes. We fall between film and IT. And, you know, if the government has been working on getting immigration codes and employment codes right for 20 years and they still haven't, I suppose it doesn't give me a lot of confidence that they're the best people to negotiate. And so I suppose I kind of like the sledgehammer thing, but I think whenever you talk about it, I want to acknowledge that I think we have to do something about the people who fall through the cracks, the cleaners and the stuff like that. And it really sounds like everyone's acknowledging that. So I suppose the concern I have is whether it is the right tool for the job. Can we do things to better support unions? You know, because this just sounds like, to me, the government's becoming a union. And wouldn't it be better to support unions or talk about living wages and things like that? Those almost seem like better options than this thing.
We'll go to our next guest very, very soon. But look, Kirk, the Business NZ, you guys and the NZCTU, you get $250,000 each a year for 3 years to support your role in coordinating these fair pay agreements. You get a bit of support here. You get paid for implementing this. Where's the downside?
I would rather that the government didn't do it. The money is of no interest to me. The reality is that if you use these instruments, and they're not restricted, by the way, in any way in the proposed legislation, they're not restricted to low paid and vulnerable workforces. There's no prevention mechanism. Mm. If a union can get up and initiate a claim, they can do it in any sector, anywhere. So that creates an incredible amount of uncertainty for employers.
Yeah, okay. So we're a great example. We could get tied up. A lot of our workers come from film. The government's just giving Amazon a 25% rebate on what they spend. So we could get, we could potentially get tied up with a film one in that, because a lot of our workers cross many industries.
All right, Kirk Hope, thank you very much for that. That is Kirk Hope, the Chief Executive of Business NZ. Listen to that is Richard Wagstaff, the President of the Council of Trade Unions. Richard, kia ora.
Kia ora.
All right, so what do you make of the fair pay agreements?
Well, we think they're a really good idea, and they put us in line with other countries in the OECD that we like to compare ourselves with. And that's simply setting some better basic minimums across industries over and above which everyone has to have their own employment agreement or their collective agreement. And it's as simple as that. And what they do is the government has created a system where employers and unions and employees get together and negotiate these minimum standards, and well, the government's not involved at all in setting them. It is the unions and the and the employers who do it. And if they can't, then a third party will determine it.
Okay. And on that, Kirk, has said somewhere, any pay deals reached wouldn't be fair because the process is essentially compulsory. Employers would be required to agree to what unions wanted with compulsory arbitration if they didn't. So some might say that old thing of unions holding the workplace to ransom.
Well, there's a few things in their media release, which is a bit strange. But I don't know why Kirk thinks the arbitrator would necessarily agree with unions. Far from it. In fact, arbitrators seldom take one side or the other. They have their own view. They would look at what's in the industry and try to set a reasonable basis. And I heard Kirk talk about bus drivers. They are topical because, in Wellington they've been locked out by a company who can't compete against other companies who have no bottom standard over which to bargain, you see. So it's about lifting the floor in industry so we can concentrate on quality of services rather than the cost of labour.
Yeah, and I think, Wallace, that's what it is. It is a bit of a sledgehammer approach, but if the majority of employers were doing the fair thing and doing the best for their workers and paying them the best, then we wouldn't need this approach. But
problem is we keep talking about industry, but we experience constantly that we don't get defined well as an industry. So we'd probably sit across three different industries, which would mean that we'd be getting lumped in. And the government governments over the world have consistently proven that they're not very good at categorising industries. They're slow, right?
Yeah.
And so that could really increase, our costs. We try and have a fair rule that we try and play largely all our people as if they're game developers, rather than paying a programmer one thing and, paying an artist way less. We try and think about fairness. That becomes very difficult if we've got a few people who are part of the film industry who then we have to pay according to that, and it can really upset the cart. So I really like the intent. I just feel like everybody relies on some foundational things like the government's going to define an industry, or a union is.
Is it about setting a base? Richard, do you want to respond to Dean?
I think if you're paying people fairly, then you've got nothing to worry about. This isn't going to be setting new high rates. It's going to be trying to scoop up the bottom rates and lift the cellar dwellers, if you like, in the pay range. I mean, the other thing is that most countries have this. And most countries actually have better productivity than us. This is in the OECD, and I would say better labour relations than us. So, you know, if it's so bad, how come they're doing so well? And thirdly, this isn't going to be like for everyone suddenly. We're talking about a handful of industries will take probably years to manage. I don't think it's going to be like Australia where they have modern awards across the whole economy. It's going to be nothing like to that scale, in my view, any time soon.
Just out of interest, before you go, Richard, how do we sit alongside Australia when it comes to, say, what's their version of a fair pay agreement?
They have a thing called a modern award system where there are industry standards right across the economy set by government. That is set by government. There isn't a negotiation process. This is actually allowing the employers and the unions to try to figure out what makes sense in any particular industry. And if they can't make sense of it, then it can go to arbitration. But our intent would be to get an agreement. I see Business New Zealand has talked about industrial action in their media release. There's no industrial action involved in this at all. These agreements have to be reached without any dispute.
Okay.
That's part of the rules.
Richard, thanks for being with us on the panel today. That is Richard Wagstaff, the President of the Council of Trade Unions. Before we had the CEO of Business NZ, Kirk Hope. Your thoughts on that? Most welcome. You can text me 2101. Email the panel at rnz.co.nz. Now, today, the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, the ASMS, the union representing thousands of senior doctors across the country, has released a report showing the alarming rate of that doctors and dentists are being overworked. Medical workloads are so bad, thousands of doctors across the country are severely burnt out, to the point one says she became suicidal after repeatedly being told by her bosses that patients would die if she took time off. The report defines burnout as not a sign of an individual weakness or failure to cope, but as a syndrome of excessive physical and psychological fatigue and exhaustion. So to discuss this issue is Executive Director of the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, Sarah Dalton. Kia ora, Sarah.
Kia ora, Wallace. How are you?
I'm well. Pretty serious findings here today. Over 50% of senior doctors experiencing burnout.
Yeah, it's a major concern, and it's even more of a concern because when we surveyed our members in 2016, very similar picture, only slightly worse. So nothing that any of the employers have done in the interim have made any positive difference.
Why? Why so bad?
It's bad because our senior medical and dental workforce is critically understaffed. It's bad because acute demand is rising at a rate greater than the current DHBs and health system is resourced to manage. And it's worse because the DHBs and other employers are leaning towards individually focused responses to burnout rather than broader organisational responses.
I'm just thinking I'll get our panellists to jump in, but having a very stressed out medical workforce as an entrenched feature, as you mentioned, I'm wondering that if we are ready for a major health overhaul, or do we need to get this right first?
I think it's probably a yes and proposition. I'm not sure if one is a reason not to do the other. But yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of change in the system and and really what's missing, I think, is proper resourcing and a proper determination to support our people. And that's something I'm hearing very strongly from our members, particularly with the public sector pay restraint announcement that's come out this week.
Ruwani, what do you think? This is something as a consumer perhaps and as a patients out there who go to their GPs, their practitioners, this is not something that they would be hearing as well.
What a huge concern, and obviously in the last year that we've been through as well, we know the importance of the work that they're all doing. But it's no surprise, is it, when you've got hospital beds in the waiting room and people clogged up and not enough staff. And you're absolutely right, Wallace. You know, how is that going to look like in terms of this radical like shake up of the health system? Where is the staff? You know, where have they all gone? What's been happening? You look at the I read a 2020 report about six doctors committed suicide in the last 2 years. You know, this is not right. There's something wrong with this whole picture. And, is it that we don't have enough people going through med school anymore? Is it a thing that you know, what is that? Is that a thing? Is that an issue that we actually don't train enough doctors now?
Sarah?
I think med school is an issue for down the line. I think our key problem at the moment is we have a thing in our collective agreement called job sizing and service sizing, where we work with our members, the doctors and dentists, to determine how many staff they need to run their service. And that is constantly being opposed and not enacted by the employers because they don't have the money to employ more staff. It's really straightforward. We already have the mechanisms in place and they are not meeting us halfway.
Dean?
Well, I make video games and we often have an out when things get really stressful saying, well, if we screw it up, no one's going to die. And unfortunately, doctors, you know, people in the fire service, police, they don't have that option. I do think just a point that you brought up was really good, which is that you have to sort of acknowledge that everyone's different. So me, I'm very pragmatic. I'd be the kind of person who'd say, hey, if we don't do this, someone's going to die. It's taken me a long time to realise that not everyone's like that and that you do need to have process, because some people you say, if someone said that to me, I'd be like, okay, that thing's really important. But for other people, they actually need support and systems around that. And I do think, I like that idea of we need to think about that centrally. And maybe I wonder if many of the people getting in those senior positions are like me. They're very pragmatic. I can handle someone. I want someone to come to me and just tell me how it is and I'll try to deal with it. But not everyone is built the same and not everyone's built like that.
And I think that's another thing, like the people that are going through, you know, training to be doctors, it's like a whole new different, you know, a different requirement now of like dealing with those things, dealing with stress and managing that, you know, like it's the mental health aspect of it has never been more important.
Sarah, thanks for being with us this afternoon. I do appreciate it. That is Executive Director of the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, Sarah Dolson. You're listening to with Ruwane Pereira and Dean Hall with me this afternoon on the panel. And to small dogs, a bit of response here too. Tracy says, I'm the owner of a Boxer Mastiff. The only time my dog has ever been attacked has been by a very small dog. After having owned small dogs also, they are far more aggressive and they do seem to suffer small dog syndrome, says Tracy. Another one here says, read the aggressiveness of small dogs. They can get away with the worst behaviour because they're not going to inflict the damage a large dog would do in the same situation. Also, larger dogs are at face height for children, and people who breed trained dogs for protection cause all sorts of problems by creating unstable killing machines. Small dogs are often indulged and reflect the insecurities. So to that, research, small dogs are, a lot in this, are more likely to behave aggressively than larger ones. According to a new study from the University of Helsinki, researchers found that because small dogs are seen as less threatening, owners are less likely to correct aggressive behaviour. And other findings include that male dogs are more aggressive than females, and anxious and fearful dogs are more likely to be aggressive. With us is animal psychologist and behaviourist Mark Vett. Mark, welcome.
Yeah, how are you, Wallace?
I'm very well. Smaller dogs, what evidence have you seen? Are they more aggressive?
Small dogs are more aggressive. Yeah, well, it's interesting. It was an interesting article, and I think we spent 45 years kind of working with dogs and aggression. I would agree that small dogs can certainly show aggression just as much or more than big dogs, but of course the gravity of the situation is much different when you've got a Rottweiler compared to a Maltese Terrier, you know, so but that's not a surprise, you know, the stats come out that way. But it's interesting. There's about 10 different forms of aggression in dogs, so it's important not to just think aggression is one thing in a dog. It's a complex of things, you know.
Dean?
So, you know, there's maternal aggression and territorial aggression and fear-induced aggression. But it's interesting to see that, and I would agree that most aggressions are fear-based. You know, the ones that, you know, that most dogs bite because they're scared, they're fearful of something. So that's good information for people to understand because a lot of, you can prevent dogs from biting you if you know that it's fear-based.
That's useful.
And you behave appropriately, yeah.
Dean, do you have a dog?
I don't. I wish I did. But you know, I mean, my takeaway from this is, yet again, we've discovered that everything that's wrong with animals is us. There's actually a really interesting article on Politico about Biden's dog being a little bit troublesome.
Yep.
And it was really interesting takes from dog you know, behaviourists and trainers about how the dogs are a product of the environment. So, you know, and that's what, you know, it says in the study and what we're hearing just now. So, you know, we're,
Everything that's wrong with dogs is about us. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was a rescue dog, you know, the one that, Biden's dog. Mm. And so he came out of a difficult situation. And, of course, they put him into a hugely different and strange environment. So that's all he was
Melania's
doing.
Garden.
That's right. So a fear-based aggression would have been what drove his behaviour in that situation, you know, being fronted by a big guard-like person. But I mean, I think, we say 60% of behaviour problems in dogs are maintained or caused by the owner. So aggressions would be well up there in that component. One of the biggest problems and the biggest problem and cause of aggression generally is not socialising your pup through the 2 to 4 month period. Mm. That's the main cause of aggression in dogs. So if we all understood that, prevention is better than cure, and we did the right thing when they're pups.
When I get a dog, everyone's going to see it. So no problem there.
Rwani, what do you think about this?
Well, our family dog is a medium-sized spoodle, so he's fine. Wallace is all good. Yeah. But I've seen in a lot of, it's like short man syndrome or the Napoleon complex. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Yeah. You're making up for the, I'm a very loud person. I'm short. I'm trying to make up for it by look at me and hear me. So, it's the same thing, right, Mark?
Yeah, and they are more vulnerable, aren't they, get a great big Great Dane with a little terrier or a little Papillon or something.
Totally.
And, they're 20 times as big. So there's definitely the whole thing is you've also got to voice your, try and stand up for yourself. But those dogs that have been selected for gaminess, the Bull Terriers and the big Bulldogs and all the bigger kind of more strong breeds, gaminess in a dog takes it. It's like punching way above its weight range. So you get certain breeds that are really, toughy, basically, and have a lot of spunk behind them.
Yeah.
And then you've got little softies that, like a King Charles Spaniel's not going to bite you, really. And if it does, it'll probably suck your thumb off or something,
Give me the yappy, give me the one that licks you to death, that one.
Adorable.
Yeah.
So cute. I found this person interesting, Mark, because we have a little Yorkshire Terrier Banjo, but he really does, our walk in our neighbourhood, first walk, and he really went up to a Rottweiler and thought it was one-to-one. The Rottweiler was thankfully behind a very large gate. It didn't scare the little Yorkie.
No.
Well, I mean, they're really, you've got to think from the dog's point of view, the variation in a dog, they're 99.96% wolf, all of them. So when you think about, from the Chihuahua through to the Great Dane, they're just all selected, slightly different, selected for different size classes as a breed. They're all got the same, everything inside them is basically canine, and they all want to be, the big dog, or they want to, they think of themselves as one of the pack, regardless whether they're the size of a shoe as opposed to a truck,
Exactly.
Mark, nice to have you on the program. I do appreciate it. That is Mark Vett, who is an animal psychologist and a behaviourist.
Let's face it, they're all more intelligent than us anyway, aren't they, Dean?
And they just want to be loved.
They just want to be loved.
Yeah, sounds like you really want to get a dog, Dean.
I don't have the time. I don't have the time.
Good on you.
I'm not going to subject a dog to that unless I can give it all my attention.
Good for you. Dean Hall and Rwani Pareto with me on Friday's panel this afternoon. It is 29 to 5, time for headlines with Murama Te Pule.